Okay, zero set. Yeah, let's go. Can you hear me? Is that better? Okay, is that better? All right, it's on. It's on. Okay, we record these digitally and we put the digital recording as an audio file on the web. It's very important that you use the website. You can check your notes, you can review. All the pictures will be in color. We can't afford to do color Xeroxes for you, so your handouts will be in black-white. And you can take notes right on those. I'm trying to add a few more slides this year, just to reduce the amount of note-taking you have to accomplish in the classes. So let's see. You have the syllabus is in two different forms. One is session by session. We don't always follow that precisely. We do our best. So I've given you another one that's in, so you can see the major topics of the class, of the lecture series. There's really two classes, you know. There's a lecture, my view of the field of neuroscience and behavior, and then readings. The readings covers some things that I cover in class also. Those areas where there's overlap, you can be sure, will be on the exams. There's also readings in areas that I don't cover in class. And you will be getting study section, study questions to work on to guide you to pay attention to what we consider the more important points. You also have a CD with your textbook, which has many study questions. More, you don't have to deal with all of those. We will select from those and make up some of our own to be giving you. Okay. I will come up with questions about the lectures, and the TAs will come up with questions about the readings. Please do them and keep up with class, and to make sure that you do what I just said, you will give quizzes every week. Okay, usually one quiz in a week. I think we'll have one on next Wednesday. We won't always have them on Wednesday. They'll often be. I don't like to tell you exactly when they'll be because the whole idea is that you keep up. I found that students perform much better since I introduced this practice. The quizzes will be 20% of the grade. There'll be a lot of them, and I know that occasionally you didn't have time to do the assignment or you didn't get enough sleep or whatever, so you'll do badly. So we will eliminate your worst two, okay? We'll just count the best ones. Now, let's see, what else do we need to cover? Questions? TAs. I'd like the TAs to introduce themselves, and so you know who they are. We've listed their names on the syllabus with their email address. They may want to, I don't know if they want to be reachable by phone, they can also give you their numbers, and we can post that on the website. Okay? So, with the TAs, introduce themselves. Brandon, what is the research you're doing? Visual. Very good. Okay, we'll be covering those topics in the second half of the term. Okay, we'll be introducing the visual system with a one session on the retina. Okay. Good. Very good. That's one area where I don't cover a whole lot in the class of pharmacology because we have a separate class in that taught by Professor Wortman. It's a very good class. But there will be some readings in that area, and you will be getting some study questions in that too. Okay, are there any questions before we get started here? You can always ask questions of me directly by email or after class, or just make an appointment if you would rather come talk directly and with any of the TAs. Okay. I don't know exactly how the TAs will divide up the various jobs here, but I'm sure that they will work that out. But we're here to help you learn everything. If I seem demanding about the quizzes and readings, and yes, my exams are not too easy, I'm trying to get out of you everything I can and get you to learn the most possible. That was the whole purpose of developing the website, putting all these files up on the web. And that's why I'm adding more of the outlines and pictures for you for the class. Now we're going to introduce the topic by talking about three types of goals of neuroscientists trying to explain behavior. Okay, trying to explain behavior of human beings and animals in neurological terms. And I can see three kinds of goals that have continued throughout the history of this field and continue today. Okay. In one of them, the idea is to explain behavior in terms of specific neural circuits. Okay. Sometimes it's called the connectionist model behavior. But it's a very complex system. So some people have simply given up on that, and it's not the goal they've pursued at all. They've instead tried to localize function, simplifying the task of relating behavior and the mind to the brain, and that's played an important role in the history of the field, and we'll give you examples of that in these introductory lectures. A third one is still different, simply trying to correlate brain and behavioral events. I'm always amazed at how we assume in the field that brain and behavior here includes our internal behavior, our thinking, our mentation. We assume as neuroscientists that behavior is always correlated with brain activity of some sort. And yet the discovery of correlations is always surprising and amazing, and it appears in the newspapers and everything. We'll assume it. But we'll also point out how that's been a major goal in the field. And I'll say a little bit at the end of the introductory lectures before we start talking about neural units and anatomy about how modern people try to synthesize these approaches in outlining neural subsystems, often focusing on just one part of the brain that they think can be separated pretty well from others. Now, this first goal of finding specific neural circuits that underlie behavior, the prime example of that in history of the field is the study of the reflex arc, which led to a philosophy called reflexology. It was also a science, but reflexology really refers to the philosophy. It became sort of a religion. Many Europeans in the 19th century. We'll say a little bit about discovery of purposive machines, and then a little bit about what a total physiological determinism does to notions of freedom and responsibility. So this first goal, if you could do it, if you could explain the behavior of any animal completely in terms of circuits, it means you could build a machine to do the same thing. You could build data. You could build an android. In the field, there's a specific story I like to tell about Carl Ashley, who in the 1920s, 1930s, helping to establish brain and behavior as a scientific field and not just part of neurology in medicine. By applying the methods of experimental psychology to the study of brain and behavior. When Lashley was a student, he encountered in a medical class histological sections, that is, cross-sections of the tissue. They were mounted on glass slides of the frog brain. And it occurred to him that if you could just use such material to see all the connections and map them out, you could completely explain the frog's behavior. That was the idea. And it's the basic idea behind this first goal. Why was it naive? Is that a realistic goal? Could I completely explain the frog's behavior? Is there any animal where we know all the connections? Does anybody know in biology? There's a little worm, C. elegans, that they know just about all the connections. All the neurons have been identified, and the whole pattern of connectivity. Has it helped us explain, predict, and control the behavior of that little worm? If not, why not? And so let's just briefly talk about that. There's many properties of neurons that aren't revealed by the histology, and even because neurons are such complex entities. You know, there are many people like to do computer simulations, and there are simulations even of complex things like behavior organisms. Some of it goes on in the media lab here in Bruce Blumberg's laboratory. Simulation studies of how cells work have been more difficult. And it's only in the last few years that that's just beginning. Cells are such complex entities. So they're not really like elements of an electrical circuit at all. Just at a very simple level, the histology won't tell you how effective a connection is. Even if you discover it, it won't even tell you it won't tell you if it excites or inhibits, or if it's active at all. It's not obvious from the histology. There are a few indications of that for some parts of the brain with the use of the electron microscope. It won't tell you about conditions of responsiveness, and this can vary tremendously depending on chemical background, temperature. And that's an area where we don't even know that much. You know, what is the importance of chemical changes in the background of neurons? We know that when certain changes occur in cerebrospinal fluid when animals sleep and when they're waking, and it's impossible by just transferring that fluid to influence an animal's behavior, but we don't know a lot about how that happens. Also, just the connections won't tell you much at all, really nothing about the time course of actions, including endogenous activity. What does that mean? It means activity generated by the cell itself without any inputs. Now, when we're dealing with reflexes, we're assuming inputs are needed. But in fact, neurons are also show endogenous activity. But I'd like to point out here that simplifications are useful, and maybe reflex model is still very useful in explaining a lot of behavior. So let's just see how far we can go with it. Its existence was first discovered by René Descartes, who published a book in Latin, De Homine, in 1662. And we'll talk a little bit about that history, and then we'll talk about how it became embodied in real anatomy with the discovery of the law of roots and the work of Ramona Cajal on the spinal cord, and then later physiological studies of Charles Scott Sherrington. So how did Descartes, who was the first to have a clear connectionist model, okay, of human behavior in terms of specific connections, how did he ever come upon such an idea. Maybe it seems obvious to you now, but at the time, that was not the mindset at all. We think it's quite possible that it happened because of the sense of humor of French royalty. In the French royal gardens, you walk through the gardens, there would be certain places in the paths where when you stepped on those places, you triggered a hydraulic mechanism, and a large doll, very lifelike, would jump out at you. I guess the king loved that. But to Descartes, it made him think that, hey, they're like androids, you know, they're behaving, and it was just triggered by a stimulus. So maybe we're like that, and animals are like that. They're simple stimuli that lead to responses. So the idea, the SR model, was born in his mind. And not only that, he could give it some embodiment because he had done dissections. He had studied the eye muscles, for example, and other parts of the body, and he noticed these nerve fibers that were... he wasn't really looking at single axons, he was looking at groups of neurons, but he did see the nerves, and he saw that they appeared to be fluid-filled tubes connected between the body surface and the nervous system, the spinal cord or the brain. And he drew pictures of this. You can see them in historical books or in his books. So he came up then with a description of how stimulus could lead to response. Let's stick with Descartes here for a minute, and let's go to this picture, actually. This is one of the famous pictures that he drew, where he's explaining in terms of his model, his little connectionist reflex model, of what happens when this boy gets his foot in the fire. Well, what does happen? Well, there's a withdrawal reflex. And the leg withdraws. But he described it this way. And, you know, it's easy to laugh at this, but then let's translate it. He says, if the fire, A, is close to the foot, B, the small parts of this fire, which move, as you know, very rapidly, have the power to move along with them the part of the skin of this foot, which they touch, and by this means, pulling the small filament, can't see it there, he had labeled it in another diagram, which was attached to it. They open at the same time the entrance of a pore where this small filament ends, just as by pulling one end of a cord, you could cause a bell attached to the other end to ring at the same time. Okay, so you see his model then is that the action of the fire here triggers movement in a fluid that moves down this tube, goes all the way to the brain, okay, and then comes back and affects the muscles. And in his dissections, he had seen these kinds of connections. Now, if you just translate, we know the hydraulic model's not correct, and if instead of pores you introduce the term synapse, which was a term that didn't arise until around 1900, we can see that Descartes actually had a pretty clear conception of reflexes. He just didn't have the anatomy all correct. And I just want to point out here that this idea that an engineering model can lead to scientific theories is very common. The discovery of the nature of homeostatic governors, for example, provided a model for how the nervous system controls visceral states, the state of blood sugar, the state of temperature, energy balance and feeding behavior and so forth. It was an important model in thinking about the nervous system. Several mechanisms which were developed mostly in World War II many of them at MIT, at the Lincoln Lab, were used to form homing devices, and that came as to physiologists as an amazing thing, because these were machines now showing purposive behavior. And there were many physiologists who used to say that you just can't explain. You can explain a lot of reflex behavior, but purposive behavior, you know, goal-directed behavior, you can't really do that in mechanistic terms. But then engineers showed that actually it's rather easy. Now, of course, our dominant model comes from computers that process information. And we think now often as cognition as information handling in a very complex system, which we know there are, most of our computers are not like this, but there are distributed parallel processing computers that in some ways are similar to the way information is handled in the nervous system. Okay, so let's go back to the notion of reflexes. I mentioned that his notion of how it works were disproved. In fact, nerves are fluid-filled tubes. He was right about that, but the conduction isn't hydraulic, it's electrical. But the fact of reflexes had been demonstrated, and the existence of them and various forms of them accumulated in centuries after Descartes. Okay? Certain lawful relationships, like between intensity, the response, and the intensity of the response and the intensity of the stimulus, for at least some reflexes, seemed to be lawful. And there were many studies of this. It became then an established model. The SR model is a somewhat broader model that was inspired by reflexes. The problem was that for centuries there still was no specific neural circuit. We had the model, we had the conception, we had the demonstrations of its existence, we even had lawful relationships. Some people thought, in fact, it was so complex that it was impossible ever to reduce these stimulus-response circuits to specific anatomical entities. But then it began to change in the 1800s with the discovery of the law of roots. Do you all know what the law of roots is? Don't they teach you that in high school? Well, you know the phrase pain in the back. Okay, well, pain comes in through nerve fibers, they reach your spinal cord through the posterior root, the back root. We call it the dorsal root. These people discovered, looking at the anatomy of the spinal cord, that the inputs and outputs that came into the central nervous system through the spinal cord came in through specific bundles of axons or nerve fibers that separated when they approached the cord. Here we see a dissection of a human embryo, actually. This is the foramen magnum right here. So the skull, here's the base of the skull. And here the bone, the vertebrae, have been broken and the spinal cord exposed. Here you can see the broken vertebrae. They've removed the top of each vertebral arch. Okay, but notice in between, here's a bone, here's a bone. In between the bone you have these nerve fibers that come as a single large bundle near the cord, and then they start branching when they go out to the periphery, to the muscles and various sensory organs. But when they get close to the spinal cord, they divide. And what you see here are a lot of little rootlets that are the dorsal roots of those nerve bundles, of the spinal nerve. So each spinal nerve divides into a dorsal root and a ventral root. And it's actually, we say root, but actually it's a series of rootlets. So you can see up and down the dorsal part of the spinal cord, there's almost a continuous series of little rootlets. Okay, this little group comes from this spinal nerve, this little group comes from this spinal nerve, and so forth. There's 32 spinal nerves like that. Okay, now here's a cross-section. Here's the one vertebral arch. This is the posterior side. And here's the spinal cord. It's enclosed in a canvas-like covering there, the dura mater. And you'll be reading about that. And here you see some of these roots, okay? And here's the spinal nerve, and it's dividing here into a ventral root and a dorsal root. You can't see the ventral root very much in these pictures. You can see some of those dorsal rootlets. Here you see a huge blood vessel. And here you see a dissection of a human embryo where they've shown the proximal part of all of the spinal nerves. Okay, if this were an adult, the spinal nerves, what happens is the spinal cord stops growing as the body continues to grow, and the roots for our legs and the whole pelvic area and the legs are inside the vertebral column but continue down quite a ways before they exit the vertebral column. Okay, and we'll see that anatomy a little later. So let's just talk now about what the significance of that anatomy was. For one thing, it simplified things because this was first noticed by Charles Bell in 1811, and he more or less published this. He actually circulated a paper among his friends, but that counts as publication. And he described some simple experiments that he did on living animals. Now, it's very hard for me to imagine how these people did this because they had no anesthesia. But they did it. And basically, he was using a knife and a little metal probe. And he discovered these roots. He knew the anatomy from dissections. And he discovered if in a living animal he could tweak those dorsal roots, he didn't get much happening, but if he touched the ventral roots, he got convulsive contractions of the muscles. He also noticed that if he cut through them, same thing. If he cut through the ventral roots, you know, he would get a violent contraction. He didn't go much further than that. But he came to the right conclusion that the spinal nerves were dividing into an input side and an output side. He came to the right conclusion from very simple and we would consider somewhat inadequate experiments. And that's what he published. We recognize the discovery of the law of roots as coming from both Bell and François Magendie, who in France published a paper in 1823 They were much more conclusive because he had a series of experiments, all which converged on the same kind of conclusion. And for example, he used the ablation technique. He found out that if he cut a series of ventral roots, the muscles in one part of the body, if he would do it in the area that innervated the rear legs, for example, though that leg would just become flaccid, the muscles would become completely relaxed. But if he cut the dorsal roots, that didn't happen. Okay. He also noticed that if he cut the dorsal roots and not the ventral roots, he could pinch the animal and get no response. Whereas if he didn't cut them, he would get reflex responses. He did the same thing using a convulsive drug, showing that it wasn't just some depressive effect of his surgery that was causing some of his findings. But even with a convulsive drug, if the ventral roots were cut, the muscles just didn't convulse at all. So the convulsive drug was acting on the nervous system. He also used a pretty modern technique. He called it galvanism, namely electrical stimulation. And if he stimulated dorsal roots, he got some movement, but not very much. And if he stimulated ventral roots, he got, strong muscular contractions. So all of this led him to conclude, he put it together, and said there's only one explanation, namely that the input and the output of the nervous system are separated in the dorsal and ventral roots. Okay, so the dorsal root is sensory, the ventral root is motor. That, of course, left the central nervous system, the spinal cord or brain, still as a kind of black box. It showed that, okay, inputs and outputs, inputs are coming in through the dorsal roots, going out through the ventral roots, but we don't know how they're connected. It still didn't give us the entire reflex circuit. That came from the work of Santiago Ramon y Cajal. And he used a technique called the Golgi method in order to visualize in sort of silhouette form the neurons. And using that stain, and I'll show you some pictures of it, he came up with the neuron doctrine that the neuron, nerve cell, was the fundamental and functional unit of the nervous system. He was not a physiologist. The physiology, though, was being done around the same time by Sherrington in England. Ramon y Cajal was working in Madrid. And Sherrington did physiological studies of spinalized cats, primarily animals with the spinal cord separated from the brain, so he could study spinal reflexes independent of the brain. And he's the one who actually named the connections form between neurons, synapse. And that's how we managed to reduce reflexes to specific neural pathways. This is the basic idea. Here's a cross-section of the spinal cord. Here you see fibers inside the dorsal root. Here's a cell body here, distributing in this little tree-like distribution inside the spinal cord, connecting to nerve cells. These little structures with branches here called dendrites, and then they have a nerve fiber or axon that goes out. So the conduction then goes this way through the cord. The Golgi method enables you to see that. And with the Golgi method, Golgi himself had used it in Italy, used his method and concluded that all nerve cells within the brain form a continuous network. There were no separation between them. That proved to be incorrect. The one who was correct in his interpretation was Ramon y Cajal. And he concluded that, in fact, these fibers made contact, often with these little swellings on the surface of other neurons. And that contact then was the way one cell could influence another cell. And Cajal concluded all that from the anatomy, but he was also familiar with physiological studies going on, particularly Sherrington. And Sherrington gave a name for these contacts. He called it the synapse. These are some pictures that I took from one of Cajal's books. Cajal would do stains, usually of very young cats and mice, and with the Golgi method. And he found that the stain worked in varying ways, depending on the factors that we don't understand very well. But the age of the animal had an influence. The way the solutions were made up had an influence. And then there were a lot of uncontrolled factors. But in some of the cases, he would get beautiful stains of the nerve fibers, the axons. In this case, he's seeing many fibers, some of which are dorsal root fibers, coming into the cord and terminating in these little end arbors, we call them. This is another one of his pictures where he's showing what we know now are ventral horn motor neurons. We call them motor because they have an axon that leaves the cord, goes out through the ventral root. So here's the ventral root forming. You see it on each side here. And these are motor neurons. And these branches of the cell are dendrites, which are the main receptive area of the cell. And he shows here other axons in red here that are contacting these dendrites. Now, the stain doesn't stain the axons red. That's Cajal's interpretation. And he turned out to be amazingly correct in his anatomical descriptions. And we think of him as the father of neuroanatomy. There were neuroanatomists before him, but he was the first to really do it in a totally comprehensive way, studying all different levels of the nervous system. Also did developmental studies, and just happened to be right about most of what he wrote. His method was quite amazing. He studied these cells through the microscope, and then he would take a walk, and he would think about what he had studied, and then he would come back, and he would draw from memory these pictures. He had a kind of eidetic memory, and very few people can come close to that kind of ability. He didn't have the kind of now drawing tubes we have. Now we probably spend much longer. Maybe we're a little more accurate, but not much, because when people do it, they usually get the same kinds of pictures Cajal did. This is his reduction of reflexes to a circuit. Here he shows a dorsal root fiber with endings, dendritic endings out here in the skin, leading to input that comes into the spinal cord by this axon that branches, but it has many little arbors inside the cord. And some of those arbors contact motor neurons defined as cells with axons going out. Okay. So, and this is contact with muscle cells, a striated muscle cell. So this was the first picture of a complete circuit explaining a reflex. Okay. And notes from Ramoni Cajal. So after Cajal and Sherrington's physiological work, before that, after Descartes, reflexology developed as a kind of philosophy, but there were many scientists who were devoted to this work, and I think it culminated in La Mettrie, 1748, who explained how you could use reflex ideas to explain even human behavior. He simply said that humans were different in only one way, complexity. The reflexes, the connections were just much more complex, and that is enough to account for human uniqueness. I think I have a... It's not what Descartes thought. Descartes thought that these reflexes that he had described, in fact, did not account for all of human behavior, but they did account for all of animal behavior. Humans, he said, had something in addition that had an independent action on these reflex connections, sort of orthogonal to them and influencing them, and he called that the soul, the rational soul, he sometimes called it. La Mettrie put it this way. He says, since all the faculties of the soul depend to such a degree on the proper organization of the brain and of the whole body, that apparently they are but this organization itself. The soul is clearly an enlightened machine. And that phrase, an enlightened machine, has often been used to describe the brain. He concluded after that, a little bit further on in this section I'm reading from here, that the soul is therefore but an empty word of which no one has any idea, and which an enlightened man should use only to signify the part of us that thinks. Well, we don't need to get emotional like that, but what we really have is a model. And we'll criticize that model, but it was the first clear stimulus response model, and it culminated in these expressions of La Mettrie. It was a mechanistic model of behavior. It had a different kind of an expression and was developed differently in Russia with the two Ivans, Ivan Sechenov, Ivan Pavlov. Sechenov was Pavlov's teacher. Sechenov himself didn't do that much experimental work, But he wrote some very interesting things. He wrote a book called Reflexes of the Brain, but he said the original title was An Attempt to Establish the Physiological Basis of Psychical Processes, but the censors didn't like that. He's not supposed to be talking about psyche at all, so he changed it to Reflexes of the Brain and got it published. And and it got him into some trouble because he was explaining all behavior in terms of such a mechanism that they told him that he was an involuntary, in his words, he said, it earned for me the charge that I was an involuntary propagator of immorality and nihilistic philosophy. And in fact, the nihilist philosopher, the young people, carried his book around Moscow. He said, unfortunately, the censor's regulations of that time prevented me from publishing an explanation, which would have easily dispelled the misunderstandings. He says, indeed, my sternest opponents can accuse me of asserting that every action, irrespective of its content, is predetermined by the nature of the given individual, and by nature of the individual, he means his anatomy and physiology, that any action is caused by a certain, sometimes insignificant external stimulus, that the action itself is inevitable, and that being so, even the worst criminal is not responsible for his crimes. That's what people claim. So he said they can say that my teaching gives the green light to shameful deeds by persuading depraved persons that they are not responsible for what they do, seeing they cannot help doing so. The stimulus occurred, the response was inevitable. But he said this last charge, the charge about criminal irresponsibility, is due to an obvious misunderstanding. Because there was no need to discuss in my treatise the matter of good and evil. My object was to analyze actions in general. And that my point was that given certain conditions, not only actions, but also their inhibition was inevitable. In other words, we have a mechanism to explain how we inhibit our actions too. But of course, he still stuck to a complete determinism. The comprehensiveness of the reflex model was greatly expanded with Pavlov's work, who showed that reflexes are plastic. They can be changed. They can be conditional upon some experience of the animal. And he called them conditional reflexes. We now usually say they're conditioned. Like if we constantly are associating a stimulus that triggers a reflex with some other stimulus that initially doesn't trigger the reflex, eventually the neutral stimulus will also trigger the reflex, at least in many cases. And that plasticity of reflexes made this SR model more complete, and it in fact inspired American behaviorism and inspired John Dewey, who formulated a lot of the philosophy of education that led to universal education in America, that anyone is educable and all people are equal and they can become whatever they want if we just get the right education. So, doesn't mean the model was correct, but it did a lot of very good things. Even purposive behavior can be. These kinds of things, the servo mechanisms and computers, were reinterpreted as they were discovered by the Russian reflexologists as simply more complex types of reflexes. The whole idea about whether such total determinism abolishes ideas of freedom and responsibility was dealt with in a very interesting way by Donald Mackay, a British physiologist and psychologist, who argued that a strict determinism is logically impossible. And Why would that be? What he was really concerned with here is whether you could argue that because behavior is physiologically determined, a person is not responsible for his actions. Because the idea is, if you had, in the way he argues this, and I've given you, I think we gave him that paper? You have the paper, okay. So read it and see what you think. But basically he's arguing that, okay, if I know the complete state of a person's nervous system, and I know all the inputs impinging on all his receptors at a given moment, a strict determinism means I could predict with complete certainty his next action. That's just an expression of what that determinism means with the reflex model. Okay. The only problem is that for that statement to be true, it's supposed to be publicly true, and if you give that statement to the person you made the prediction about, of course, what could happen? We don't know. It could go either way. That's the problem. It requires a different kind of truth. So he says it doesn't take determinism away, but it means that you can't argue against freedom and responsibility because they are not dealt with well by such a model. Okay. So you read that paper and you can let me know what you think of it. And what we're going to do next time is we'll go to why some people thought that the nervous system was so impossibly complex. When they got to the brain, especially the human brain, they gave up on the idea of ever specifying complete circuits. But they found they could localize function in very interesting ways. So we'll talk about that next time.